Welcome to the Security Nexus Deep Dive. Today we're looking at something that sounds almost like historical warfare, like World War I or World War II thinking, but for the digital age. How do you pull off a data Dunkirk? How do you get your nation's essential information to safety when, well, the bombs are falling, digitally or physically? And we're not just talking about losing some spreadsheets here. This is about survival. So we're diving deep into information survival strategies, things like rapid offsite backups, the tricky business of key escrow, even jurisdiction shopping and keeping governance going. The stakes are incredibly high. Think about this. Disasters have cost over $1 trillion in the last decade alone. And maybe even more critical, look at it all, point out that over 40% of companies that have to shut down for just 3 days, they fail within 3 years. Why? Because they lose the information, the data they need to actually recover. It's like institutional amnesia. Now, before we get into the nuts and bolts of survival, we want to invite you to check out the securitynexus.net. The Security Nexus is a Maryland-based national security consultancy. We focus on strategic advice, education, and public engagement. Through things like this deep dive, our blogs, training, and consulting work, our whole mission is really to inform, educate, and empower. We want to give professionals and the public clear, accessible, actionable knowledge on cyber threats, hybrid warfare, and strategic security. Okay, so let's really dig into this problem, information survival.
It's so important to frame this right. Survival isn't luck. It has to be a planned system. Subjomnia and their colleagues, they really treat organizational resilience as this complex strategic problem. It's not just, hitting back up. It's about managing your resources, your information flow, strategically, tactically, operationally, all at once. And it's a continuous thing, like it all. And make this great point. Disaster management isn't linear, it's a cycle. You prepare, you respond, you recover, and then you mitigate for the next time. Digital continuity has to be woven into every single one of those phases.
Right. So phase one, maybe, the immediate reaction. Disaster hits locally. Your first thought has to be, get the essential data far away and fast. We all kind of know the basic 3-2-1 backup rule, right? Three copies, two different formats, at least one offsite. But for critical national stuff, just one cloud backup, that's probably not going to cut it against, say, an EMP or a major cyber attack.
Exactly. That's where things get much more sophisticated. We're moving past simple cloud storage. We're looking at these highly secure federated systems. Research from Malomo et al. Talks about something called the Blockchain-Enabled Federated Cloud Computing Framework, BFC2. Think of it as the modern high-security digital vault.
Okay, BFC2, federated. What does that actually mean in practice? How does it help?
It means geographical resilience. It's like having safety deposit boxes in different countries, but for data. The BFC2 idea, basically, is built on securing those offsite assets through jurisdictional separation.
So how does it work if I upload a critical file?
Well, that file, let's say it's super sensitive, like national infrastructure blueprints, it doesn't just get stored as one thing. It gets cryptographically split into encrypted pieces. Then those pieces are deliberately sent to different physical cloud centers. And crucially, these centers are in different places, maybe different states, maybe even different countries with different legal systems.
Ah, I see. So redundancy isn't just having copies. It's having copies under different physical and legal umbrellas.
Precisely. It defends against a single point of failure, whether that failure is a physical attack or maybe political pressure in one location.
That makes a lot of sense. But are these just theoretical frameworks, or are systems like this actually out there being used?
Oh, absolutely. You've got real systems like Sahana, which is open source, and WebEOC. That one's used by agencies like the New Hampshire Division of Homeland Security for crisis management. But the thing they all rely on, as Lyell highlight, is having data that's not just there, but structured. Usable, fast.
Structured data.
Yeah, you need those backed up GIS maps, the transaction logs, the operational data, all organized so that specialized software can quickly perform information extraction. Mm. Figure out who's who, what's related to what events are happening. Mm. You need that situational awareness in minutes, not days or weeks. And that hinges entirely on having accessible, well-structured data ready to go.
Okay, so let's say we've done that. We've used something like BFC2. Scattered our vital national data across the globe, split it up nicely. Great start. But now the really hard part. If we need that data back, maybe urgently for recovery, how do we make sure only the authorized government entities can reassemble and decrypt it? How do we keep it out of the hands of adversaries? That takes us right into the very complex world of key escrow.
It's a classic problem with huge implications.
There's that famous example from the 90s, right? The Clipper chip. IE Communications Magazine detailed the government's key escrow system, KES, back then. The lengths they went to for security even then were pretty incredible. It tells us a lot about the principles involved.
It really does. The core idea wasn't just fancy tech. It was fundamentally bureaucratic, almost. They engineered it so no single person could ever possess the full key or even know its value. They enforced this extreme separation of duties. You had escrow officers, programmers, family key agents, escrow agents, all distinct roles, separate people.
Yeah, I remember reading about that. The goal was explicitly stated. No individual ever needs to see or know the value of any cryptographic key or key component.
Exactly. And the procedure to actually decrypt something, it was intense.
An authorized official needed two different escrow officers from two separate agencies to physically show up with their encrypted key parts. They'd bring them to a special key escrow decrypt processor. Only when both parts were there together could the unique key be reconstructed. That's a high bar.
A very high bar. And that fundamental concept, split and control, it carries right through into modern systems like the BFC2 vault Maloma would all describe.
So how does BFC2 implement that? Still physical key parts?
Not physically, but cryptographically. It uses dual control enforced through specialized keys and processes like key stretching.
Okay, key stretching, sequential decryption. Can you break that down a bit?
Sure. Think of it like the two-person rule for launching a missile, but digital. There's a sensitive file, sort of a map file, that knows where all the scattered pieces of the real data are stored. That map file itself is encrypted, and it cannot be opened by just one party. It needs to be decrypted in sequence by two different entities. First, say, the system's block generator uses its special key. Then the client's own manager, the CIM, uses its special key.
So one after the other.
Exactly. It requires both keys used in the right order. This builds in huge accountability. It means even a high-level insider who compromises one part of the system still can't get to the crown jewels alone.
Okay, that's securing the stored data. But this data Dunkirk scenario, it's not just about having backups sitting somewhere safe. It's also about maintaining communication, keeping essential functions running during the crisis, right? Especially if the normal network's internet, phone lines are down or destroyed.
Absolutely. That's the continuity of operations, continuity of governance aspect. Static backups are crucial, but not sufficient during an active event.
So what does that look like? How do you operate without infrastructure?
This is where some really innovative tech comes in. Wang and colleagues in AE describe something called Rescue Chain. It's a secure blockchain system, but here's the kicker. It's designed to be infrastructure free. It runs on networks of unmanned aerial vehicles, UAVs, or drones, specifically for disaster rescue.
Okay, blockchain on drones, how does that work? Drones usually have limited power and computing ability.
Right, and that's the clever part. They use something called vehicular fog computing, or VFC. The resource-constrained UAVs, which are vital for eyes in the sky and initial assessment, they don't do all the heavy processing themselves. Instead, they offload computationally intensive tasks. Think real-time image analysis for finding people or tracking multiple moving objects to nearby ground vehicles.
Ground vehicles, like ordinary cars and trucks.
Potentially, yes. Or emergency vehicles. Mm-hmm. They act as mobile fog nodes, providing computing power close to the source. This saves precious battery life on the UAVs. It speeds up the processing because the data doesn't have to go far. And it lets critical operations continue, even if the central command center and all the cell towers are gone.
Wow. So it's a decentralized, moving, ad hoc network that's genuinely resilient.
It really is. It's operational continuity defined by mobility and decentralization.
It seems like the answer to chaos often involves embracing a different kind of distributed order.
That's a great way to put it. And connecting this back to the bigger resilience picture, Kay Houskin makes a really important point. Cyber resilience isn't just about tech. It involves a whole ecosystem of actors. You've got governments, individuals, insurance companies, and of course, the threat actors themselves. Mm. True resilience means being able to resist, respond, and recover effectively across that whole ecosystem.
And Houskin talks about different types of actors, not just good guys and bad guys.
Exactly. You have the obvious non-threat actors like governments trying to protect things. You have clear threat actors like hackers or state adversaries. But then there's this third category, which can be really tricky. Hybrid actors.
Hybrid. What does that mean?
These could be companies, maybe even internal government departments, that aren't malicious, but they might inadvertently compromise resilience. Maybe through poor security practices, misconfigurations, or just not understanding their role in the bigger picture.
Ah, the accidental threat.
Right. and designing systems like BFC2 for secure storage or Rescue Chain for mobile operations requires anticipating all these behaviors, malicious, accidental, and hybrid. You simply can't rely on trust alone in these critical systems.
Which also brings up the idea of jurisdiction, doesn't it? If your data is scattered and your operations are mobile,
right,
how do you maintain control and trust?
That leads us to jurisdictional resilience, making sure the data's integrity, its truthfulness, remains verifiable no matter where the operations are physically happening or whose local laws might theoretically apply.
How do you achieve that?
Well, again, looking at technologies like blockchain, think about trusted data storage architectures for major national infrastructure. Wang et al. Describe applying this to China's high-speed rail control system, CTCS3. They use blockchain not just for security against tampering, but crucially, for ensuring integrity, non-repudiation, proving who did what when, and traceability of essential operational data.
So even if parts of the rail network are in different regions under different local authorities,
the core operational data remains consistent and verifiable across the entire system. The disaster might take out a regional control center, but the system's overall data governance, the verifiable truth, persists because it's cryptographically secured and distributed.
Okay. So we started with this idea of data Dunkirk, this urgent, almost military-style evacuation of critical national information. And we've seen it's not just one thing. It's this combination of sophisticated planning, almost mathematical.
Right, the resource allocation piece.
Then physically and jurisdictionally scattering the data using things like BFC2, locking it down with multi-party controls like advanced key escrow.
The dual control mechanisms.
And finally, leveraging these decentralized mobile networks like Rescue Chain with UAVs and fog computing to keep things running during the crisis.
It paints a picture of resilience that's much more dynamic and distributed than just simple backups.
Absolutely. It feels like the goal has shifted. It's not just about preventing the attack anymore, though that's still vital. It's equally about ensuring rapid, verifiable operational recovery, using tech to manage both the digital and the human bureaucratic security risks.
And perhaps here's a final thought to leave you with on this deep dive. Consider the sheer volume of critical data we're talking about. Wang et al. Mentioned, for instance, the archives generated just for quality control during the construction of a major water conservancy dam. Staggering. Now, if a nation's vital history, its safety logs, its critical infrastructure blueprints are all stored using these hyper-secure, deliberately distributed methods, what happens to concepts like international treaties and data sovereignty, especially when recovery might mean needing to retrieve essential data that you intentionally stored across multiple international borders? How does national security itself evolve in that world? Something to chew on.